And now, Virgin Most Powerful Radio is pleased to present Hands-On Apologetics with renowned Catholic author and apologist, Gary Matuta.
Welcome, everybody. Welcome to Hands-On Apologetics. You have entered into Virgin Most Powerful's Apologetics Dojo. I am Gary Matuta, and we are going to go on yet another adventure into explaining, defending the faith with clarity and charity. It's great to be with you, and thank you so much for tuning in. We're going to have, as always, a really interesting show. I'm so blessed to have such great people who are willing to come on, chat with me, to spar with the likes of me on the air. And one of those great blessings is our guest today. He's new to the dojo. His name is Joseph Pierce. Now, many of you may be familiar with his great literary output. He's done fantastic work on Shakespeare and the Catholic background of Shakespeare, Chesterton, Belloc, you name it. He's pretty much... he wrote about these great literary Catholic heroes of ours. But what many people don't know about Joseph Pierce is that he's a convert. And what he converted from was he used to be a neo-Nazi anti-Catholic Protestant. And he underwent a very dramatic conversion experience that changed his life, actually starting in prison in England, to becoming what he is today. And I think he's really a jewel of the faith and certainly somebody that I think a lot of Catholics have benefited from his insights, his writings. He's also incredibly witty, so I'm not going to try to spar with wits in him. I'm just going to ask questions and keep my head low. So that's, you know, you have to know how to act in the dojo, you know, how to explain the faith. And as a host, I'm going to keep my head down, protect myself as far as sparring with wits, because I cannot contend with the likes of him. So he's going to be coming on after the first break. And as always, we have our exercises, if you will, try to sharpen our critical thinking skills. Today, we look at finding the fallacy. And the fallacy for today is the red herring fallacy. And the Meet Early Church Father is St. Justin the Martyr. So a great early church father, very interesting fallacy. And when I have Joseph Pierce come, you can ask questions. And please do. Join us at 888-526-2151. That's 888-526-2151. And we'll put you on as soon as we can. And in case you have questions that perhaps you're listening on a podcast or there's something that you won't be able to grab your cell phone and call in, you can always send your questions to the dojo mailbox at questions at handsonapologetics.com. That's questions at handsonapologetics.com, all one word, handsonapologetics. And I'll be glad to read your email. In fact, I was hoping to maybe have a day this week to go through the email, but it looks like I won't be able to do it. So I want to thank everybody for those who have emailed and still haven't heard a response on the air. Thank you so much for your patience. I promise I will get to them. It's just we've just been having some great guests and what can I say? It's, you know, so much of a good thing. But we will get to them. I promise, sooner or later. And it's time for our shout outs to those watching on live stream. On social media, at Facebook and YouTube. Hello, everybody. Great to see everyone. Yes, I did catch the emojis. It's great to see familiar names. And so if you want to check out Hands-On Apologetics, you can see me. It's Lent. That would be a good penance for you to actually watch me do the broadcast. It's, you know, broadcast live on Facebook, YouTube, and of course, you can always listen over to radio, various radio stations throughout the United States and elsewhere. And also, you know, I need to point this out because it's a valuable, valuable resource, is the Virgin Most Powerful website, virginmostpowerfulradio.org, where you can access every single program we've done on Virgin Most Powerful, not only my show, but also Jesus 911, Terry and Jesse's show, Happy Hour, you know, everything we put out, it's up there, and you can access it And that way, if you just so happen to miss the show, don't worry. You can always check it out later on. In fact, you can help us out at the same time. Please support us by sharing us. Tell your friends about us. Like us. You know, do all the social media stuff to get attention. Because, you know, there's lots of great material out there. We need to share it. You know, share the love. Also, we appreciate your prayers for all of us here at Virgin Most Powerful Radio. You can't imagine how much that helps us, just the spiritual support. And also, if you can, we also appreciate your generous contributions to the network, because even though we're doing the Lord's work, like I say, you know, we still have to pay electric bills and so on. And so your generous monthly contributions helps us out incredibly in that area. So thank you so much. So without further ado, why don't we jump to our Finding the Fallacy? All right, so our Finding the Fallacy today is the Red Herring Fallacy. The Red Herring Fallacy is, it's basically something that's introduced into a conversation or an argument that tries to mislead or distract away from the relevant or important topic or question and divert it to something else, okay? So think of it, you know, red herring is a fish. Think of it as a particularly smelly fish. And its aim is to throw you off the scent of the argument. It's also kind of very similar to what's known as a non sequitur, okay? Non sequitur means it doesn't follow. So red herring basically may be a way of throwing people off the track. Let me give you an example. Let's say you're talking to someone about the truth of the Catholic faith, and then they start bringing up, you know, well, there's so many bad Catholics, and you have a scandal and so on, and, you know, what about that? Well, that could be a red herring, because if the question at hand is whether or not the Catholic Church is the church instituted by Christ to preach throughout time, really, whether or not people live up to that teaching is a red herring. It's a different question. It's related, but it really doesn't follow. I mean, even if none of that happened, you still have the question, is it true or not? And this happens a lot, especially when people don't have a very clear understanding of what the question is at hand, or maybe they might feel like they're being cornered or they don't have answers. Sometimes they'll throw out a red herring argument and hope you'll go after that instead of pursuing the line that you're in. So that's our fallacy for today, the red herring. Aha. Love it. All right. Let's jump to the early church father. And this particular early church father is one of my favorites, by the way. St. Justin the Martyr, who lived roughly around AD 100 or 110. He died roughly AD 165. As you can tell by his name, he's a martyr of the church. And what I love about St. Justin was he was born in paganism in and around Palestine, around the year 100, right? Around the turn of the first century. And as a young man, he loved philosophy. In fact, he went to various philosophical schools like the Stoics and the Peripatetics and the Pythagoreans and the Platonists and so on. And he was really dismayed because it seemed like they were more interested in collecting money rather than giving truth and finding truth. And there's a story he gives about him walking along the seashore, dejected and kind of fed up with philosophy in general, where he meets an old man who tells him about the true philosophy of Christianity. And that was a life-changing moment for Justin. He became Christian. And he also became an ardent defender of the faith. And several of his apologetics works are available today, two treaties in defense of Catholicism against pagans, and also a dialogue with a Jewish fellow named Trypho. They're still available today. You can read them online. Fascinating stuff. So he arrived at Rome. He founded a school, which he had Tatian the Syrian, another early church father, as a pupil. And he eventually was martyrdom along with six other companions. He was beheaded sometime around between the years AD 163 and AD 167, most likely 165. And like I said, he was a very prolific writer. Like you said, he wrote two defenses to the pagan emperor defending Christianity, and then also that dialogue with Trypho, which, by the way, is very long, and it's also the earliest known extra-biblical debate, if you will, between a Christian and a Jew. Justin's probably regarded as one of the most important second-century Christian apologists. According to Jurgens, which we use for our Meet the Early Church Father segments, he says his style is tedious and labored, making him difficult to read, yet there's a note of intense sincerity in all that he wrote. And I have to agree with that. If you ever, you know, it's Lent, and especially if you want to be a defender of the faith, it'd be good to know some of the writings of Justin the Martyr. And like I said, you can get those, they're available free online. Just one website I use, and I'm not endorsing it, I don't get any pay or anything for it. But one website I use frequently for the quotes from early church fathers and accessing their whole writings is newadvent.org website, which I think is affiliated with the Knights of Columbus. And so you can get all the early church fathers there. You can get this access to Summa Theologica, St. Thomas, the Bible, and Catholic Encyclopedia, and lots of other goodies as well. There's other websites as well, but for me, that's my one-stop shopping place. And that's our Meet the Early Church Father for today, St. Justin the Martyr. Coming up next, we are going to be talking with Catholic convert Joseph Pierce about his journey from a hate group to the Catholic Church. Stay tuned, everybody. It's going to be a very interesting conversation.
This is Terry Barber inviting you, all the men, to a men's conference June 15th at the Sacred Heart Chapel. This is going to be a day where we're going to talk about true masculinity. You know, there's a problem in the Catholic Church today. We have very few men who love the Catholic faith. And I know a lot of the wives that I'm listening to right now are saying, I want my husband to be on fire for the faith. Send him to the men's conference. Your son, send him to the men's conference by going to virginmostpowerfulradio.org or call 877-526-2151. That's June 15th. When your husband comes back from this conference or your son, they're going to have a different view about their Catholic faith because they're going to meet three men who love Jesus and his bride, the church, and are going to instill in them a love for Christ and his church, the Eucharist, Our Lady. Bring them to virginmostpowerfulradio.org. Sign up there or call 877-526-2151. Full sheen ahead.
It is only because of your continued prayers and generous donations that Virgin Most Powerful Radio can broadcast live each weekday. We count on your spiritual and financial support because you understand the urgent need for Catholic programming that shares the gospel with clarity and charity, but without compromise. Please prayerfully consider becoming a monthly donor. You can set it up with the touch of a button on our website, CatholicRC.org.
Buying or selling your home or your business property? This is Terry Barber. Real Estate for Life underwrites the Terry and Jesse Show, and they can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. And when they receive their referral fee, they will give 80% of it to a pro-life organization. Wow! That's 80%! RealEstateForLife.org, 877-LIFE-US1.
Now, back to Hands-On Apologetics with Gary Machuda. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 888-526-2151. Here's Gary.
And welcome back, everybody, listening to Hands-On Apologetics. And we're going to introduce our guest for today, who is Joseph Pierce. Joseph is a senior contributor to the Imaginative Conservative. He's a native of England, and Mr. Pierce is director of book publishing at the Augustine Institute, editor of St. Austin Review, editor of Faith and Culture, series editor of Ignatius Critical Editions. He's also an author of numerous books, which, you know, just to give you a little sampling, The Quest of Shakespeare, Tolkien, Man and Myth, C.S. Lewis and the Catholic Church, Literary Converts, Wisdom and Innocence, A Life of G.K. Chesterton, and Old Thunder, A Life of Hilaire Belloc. Welcome to Hands on Apologetics, Joseph Pierce.
Oh, my pleasure. Good to be here.
Well, thank you for coming. You know, I should begin with an apology. So since it's an apologetics program, I should start with an apology. We first met years ago at dinner with Al Cresta and his wife, and you and your wife, and me and my wife. And I don't think I said one word the entire dinner. And the reason for that was you to your wits and your knowledge, I was just outgunned. So I figured it'd be best just to keep my head low and enjoy the evening.
Well, you survived the experience to fight another day, clearly.
That's true. That's true. So, Catholics are very familiar with your writing. You've done so much good work in Catholic literary greats, but we really don't know your background until your biography or autobiography on Race with the Devil. Why don't you walk us through? What was your upbringing? How were you raised? Were you raised Catholic or non-Catholic?
No, I was raised non-Catholic. In fact, I was raised very largely anti-Catholic. My father particularly was hostile to Catholicism when I was growing up. And, my father was probably the biggest single influence upon my childhood. I had a good, close relationship with my father. And one of the, negative consequences of that is I just took as gospel everything my father believed. And so a large part of my life has been unlearning at least some of the stuff he taught me. By no means all of it. I learned some good things from him too, but yeah, he was anti-Catholic. He was also at least at the time I was growing up, a racist. I mean, people are dynamic, and what he was in the 1960s and 70s when I was growing up, he also mellowed later on, and he was also received into the church. So I am at pains to make sure that people don't sort of picture my father as some evil monster. But certainly when he was at his worst was when he was at his most influential on me, because that's when I was a child, and that's when he was going through, should we say, his racist and anti-Catholic phase of his life.
Yeah, any idea why he was like that? Was that how he was raised, or...?
Yeah, well, I do think in the English culture generally of his generation and further back, anti-Catholicism was something that you almost breathed in the air. It goes back to the Reformation in England and the anti-Catholic propaganda that followed in its wake. But also, my father was raised in the East End of London at a time when there's an awful lot of Irish immigration. And, there were lots of fights between the English and the Irish in the pubs, particularly over politics. And so my father sort of, carried that, if you like, hostility to the Irish and coupled that with his hostility to Catholicism. And I think you put those two things together, and that was probably the root of his anti-Catholicism when I was a child.
Yeah, yeah. So, okay, so, you're raised in a home where, these particular values are given, and you said you readily accepted it. So what happened when you left home? Did it increase or decrease?
Well, basically, I went off the rails in my teenage years, taking what I'd learned at my father's knee to extremes. So at the age of 15, I joined a white supremacist organization, what could probably be fairly accurately described as a neo-Nazi organization in England. And I rose through the ranks of that and became one of its leaders. And I was involved in that organization for over 10 years, from the age of 15 to the age of about 26, for editing a magazine, I was actually sentenced to prison twice, and spent my 21st and 25th birthdays in prison for editing a magazine and publishing material likely to incite racial hatred. So that was. That was my angry young years, and at the same time, I was also very anti-Catholic and was involved in the anti-Catholic Protestant terrorist organisations in Northern Ireland during the Troubles. So I was involved with the UDA, the Ulster Defence Association, and the UVF, the Ulster Volunteer Force. And I was a member of an anti-Catholic secret society, a sort of Freemasonic anti-Catholic organisation called the Orange Order. And I was a member of that for several years also. So, between the age of 15 and the age of 26, I was very anti-Catholic and a political radical and extremist.
Yeah, so that was like a exponential rise. I mean, in taking prejudice and then kicking it up a notch to actual, I guess you could say like quasi-terrorist activity.
Well, the irony is, you know, that it was because of my idealism, and this is something we need to realize is that that a youthful idealism can very easily become something dangerous and destructive. We see it with obviously Islamic fundamentalists, we see it with white supremacists, we can see it with all sorts of anger manifesting itself in politics. So, it was because of my idealism and taking that idealism to an extreme that I ended up being this angry young man involved in radical politics. But, that the idealism needed to be baptized, basically, and I'm still an idealist, except now I have, by the grace of God, the right ideals, and I'm serving Christ and not serving any political ideology.
Yes, yes. Now, typically with teenagers, though, they rebel against their parents. They go. I know so many kids that I grew up with, in the 80s, where they had the nicest, prim and proper parents, and they would have mohawks and get into speed metal and countercultural things. But so. You didn't really have a rebellion against your parents. You kind of just took
well,
it to
Well, I think
an...
I had a good loving relationship with my father. My father was a major influence upon me. And, I wanted to be in my father's image. So,
interesting.
So no, it wasn't rebellion against my parents, but it was certainly rebellion against my public school education back in England, which was very much dominated by a radical Marxist agenda. And at least my father taught me to see through that. But, of course, I reacted against that bad thing with something which was at least equally as bad.
Interesting. Well, tell us a little bit about that. What were some of the values that were instilled in public education in England?
Well, basically, most of my teachers were certainly sympathetic towards radical socialism and Marxism, and this was expressed in the curriculum, which also was largely a socialist curriculum. So the books that we were taught reflected a sort of socialist view of things. So my history lessons was all about the rise of socialism in the 19th and early 20th century in England. The literature we taught was taught for propagandistic purposes, or even Shakespeare, Romeo and Juliet, and I was taught that was taught in a way which is totally contrary to what I now know Shakespeare was teaching, because Shakespeare was actually teaching profound Christian morality in that play, but that was not the way it was taught. It was taught to me because by the teachers who clearly misunderstood the play that the youthful rebellion of Romeo and Juliet against their parents was a good thing, and that we should basically follow our passions and not worry about reason, and there was something beautiful even about their suicide. And I became aware, I couldn't necessarily articulate it, that my public school education was a brainwashing exercise, and I rebelled against it, and therefore I was immune to it. But the trouble is, of course, that I went to the other extreme.
Right, yeah, yeah. I heard you speak about to thine own self be true. That was another thing that was twisted from Shakespeare.
Absolutely, that was actually the motto of the high school I went to, and it was emblazoned in big letters behind the auditorium. This above all, to thine own self be true, William Shakespeare. My father taught me to revere William Shakespeare, so my father wasn't particularly religious, but he did almost idolize England, and for my father, Shakespeare was the greatest ever Englishman, so it's the nearest person we ever got to a god, if you like. So, I idolized Shakespeare, and so I thought, well, I'll make that my motto, and of course, that motto is fundamentally relativist. This above all, to thine own self be true, means basically that you make up your own rules, and as long as you're true to your own rules, that's all that matters. Now, what I didn't realize at the time was those words were not spoken by Shakespeare. They were written by Shakespeare, but they were spoken by a character in the play Hamlet, who's actually a poisonous character and an evil character and a character who's condemned in the play. So the point is that my school didn't differentiate between, you know, Shakespeare, what Shakespeare believed, and what evil characters in his plays believed. And obviously there's a big difference. And it took me years to actually unravel that.
Yeah. Talk about ironic. And then not only that, but also published books and especially, one of your books or several of them underscore the Catholicity of Shakespeare.
Yeah, I've written three books now that I think show definitively and beyond all reasonable doubt that Shakespeare was a believing Catholic at a time when being a Catholic in England was illegal, where basically in being a practicing Catholic in England you were an outlaw, and to be a Catholic priest or to harbor and hide a Catholic priest was punishable by death. So this was the culture in which Shakespeare lived. But I show it in three books. The first book, The Quest for Shakespeare, shows the biographical evidence from the facts of Shakespeare's life that we know that show that he was a believing Catholic. And then I wrote two other books, Through Shakespeare's Eyes and Shakespeare on Love, in which I show the textual evidence from Shakespeare's plays and poems for his Catholicism.
Yeah, did your father ever read some of that? That must have been very odd.
Yeah, I mean, my father was an avid reader of everything I wrote and published. Everything I wrote prior to his death in 2005, he would have read. I think, however, that the Shakespeare books came too late for that. But my father came a long way, as did I, and you know, he was received into the church, and the last time I saw him alive in the hospital, back in 2005, he and I prayed the rosary together. He received the last rites of the church. He ended very happily. So, you know, he and I have both been on the journey, if you like, together, and we both ended up in a far better place than we were in the 70s.
Yeah, well, thanks be to God for that. Well, when we come on the other side of the break, let's talk a little bit about how you got into prison and some of the inklings you kind of had that perhaps Catholicism may have a grain of truth to it. Does that sound good?
I do. Thank you. Yeah, we'll do.
Okay. Well, you're listening to Hands on Apologetics, folks, and we're talking with one of, I think, the best writers out there on the literary greats in our Catholic heritage, Joseph Pierce, and specifically about his life in his book, Race with the Devil. Stay tuned, everyone. We'll be right back.
This is Terry Barber inviting you, all the men, to a men's conference June 15th at the Sacred Heart Chapel. This is going to be a day where we're going to talk about true masculinity. You know, there's a problem in the Catholic Church today. We have very few men who love the Catholic faith. And I know a lot of the wives that I'm listening to right now are saying, I want my husband to be on fire for the faith. Send him to the men's conference. Your son, send him to the men's conference by going to virginmostpowerfulradio.org or call 877-526-2151. That's June 15th. When your husband comes back from this conference or your son, they're going to have a different view about their Catholic faith because they're going to meet three men who love Jesus and his bride, the church, and are going to instill in them a love for Christ and his church, the Eucharist, Our Lady. Bring them to virginmostpowerfulradio.org. Sign up there or call 877-526-2151. Full sheen ahead.
It is only because of your continued prayers and generous donations that Virgin Most Powerful Radio can broadcast live each weekday. We count on your spiritual and financial support because you understand the urgent need for Catholic programming that shares the gospel with clarity and charity, but without compromise. Please prayerfully consider becoming a monthly donor. You can set it up with the touch of a button on our website, catholicrc.org.
Buying or selling your home or your business property? This is Terry Barber. Real Estate for Life underwrites the Terry and Jesse Show, and they can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. And when they receive their referral fee, they will give 80% of it to a pro-life organization. Wow! That's 80%! RealEstateForLife.org, 877-LIFE-US1.
This is Jesse Romero. You're listening to Hands-On Apologetics with Gary Machuda on Virgin Most Powerful Radio.
Welcome back, everybody. We are chatting with Joseph Pierce and his journey into the Catholic faith. And we were just talking about how his background and even the educational system had more or less impelled him towards some radical racist groups. And tell me a little bit about how you got involved with these groups. I mean, how do you meet these people? Obviously, you don't put out an ad in the paper asking.
Yeah, well, in the 1970s in England, the white supremacist organizations were actually quite popular. There was a groundswell of opposition to the scale of immigration to England, and where I grew up in the East End of London, the National Front, the organisation which I joined, was actually very popular. It was getting 10% of the vote in my area, for instance, and as much as 20% of the vote in areas fairly close to where I lived. Basically, when I was 15 years old, I came across a group of people, National Front members, selling their newspaper in the main street where I lived, and I just stood by them and asked if I could join and got myself involved. And I got very, very heavily involved, as I said. And at the age of 16, I was editing a magazine called Bulldog, and that made national headlines on the TV. And so that propelled me to the leadership of the party. I became chairman of the Young National Front, which is the youth movement. And then for editing that magazine, as I said earlier, I was sentenced to prison twice, in 1982 and in 1985. For publishing material that was considered likely to incite racial hatred under Britain's Race Relations Act.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I was wondering what the infringement was that got you in jail.
Yeah, I mean, those sort of hate crimes aren't part of the legal system over here, and it's a very difficult situation because, you know, on the one hand, I certainly do believe in free speech, certainly where politics is concerned, but obviously I don't believe in absolute free speech because I don't believe in child pornography and things like that. Obviously, some things need to be against the law. So the real question is, you know, what things need to be against the law? And I think that for the most part, the United States is a freer country than England insofar as there is more freedom of speech and there's not so much hate speech, which people threatening to be sent to prison for. But on saying that, I'm ashamed of what I did write, and whether or not I should have been sent to prison for it, it was something which was designed to damage relations between the various ethnic groups in England, and that's something which I obviously now feel ashamed.
Yeah, yeah. So when you were sent to prison the first time, apparently it didn't work. You know, I imagine you probably felt more like a martyr.
Certainly I was considered to be a martyr by my comrades. I consider myself to be a martyr and a political soldier, and basically spent the prison sentence getting myself in shape physically so that when I came out, I would be a better political soldier than I was when I went in. So, yeah, I came out more hardline than ever after the first sentence.
Yeah. So you immediately, I take it, went back to editing and then ended up for the same offense?
Yeah, I came out of prison, continued to edit the magazine as I had before, and in consequence, my house was raided and the evidence was found that proved that I was still editing the magazine, and I was charged once again with the same offense. So the first time I received a 6-month prison sentence, and the second time I received a 12-month prison sentence.
Right, and that's really where God begins to really work in your life, I think. Can you kind of walk us through how God slowly kind of brought you along?
Yeah, well, some seeds of, should we say, doubt about my own beliefs and some seeds of Catholic belief had been sown before the second prison sentence by my discovery of G.K. Chesterton, and I started to read his books, mostly first of all just for his political ideas, which I found attractive. But of course, you know, reading more and more Chesterton, I began to see that Catholicism wasn't what I thought it was. You know, my anti-Catholicism was based upon a false understanding of what the church was and what its beliefs were. So some seeds of doubt had been planted. That's the first thing. So I wasn't the radical without any doubts when I went back the second time. But at the beginning of that second prison sentence, I found myself in my prison cell holding some rosary beads. And I don't know how I got the rosary beads, who gave them to me, where they came from, but I was holding these rosary beads. And for the first time in my life, and I was almost 25 years old at this point, I had a great desire to pray. And obviously I couldn't pray the rosary because I didn't know the Hail Mary or the Glory Be or the Apostles' Creed, and I'd forgotten the Our Father, which I had been taught when I was a child. But what I did do was just to mumble sort of inarticulate prayers while I fumbled the beads. And it's almost as if, you know, certainly answers, healing, a great desire for conversion entered me almost immediately once I began this life of prayer and I began to go to Mass during that second prison sentence.
Wow. So just by, you know, kind of stumbling through the prayer and the fact that you even had the impetus to pray, that's, I think, amazing. Just taken from
it was obviously a gift in the sense that it was given by God, this desire for him. Nothing for which I want to make any prideful claims of my own, but certainly, you know, that the seeds of faith had been planted by G.K. Chesterton and my reading of him, and I discovered, you know, through my love of Chesterton, I discovered Hilaire Belloc and C.S. Lewis and these great 20th century Christian apologists, and they began to lay the foundations, if you like, for what would become the faith, and so the faith in me, and so that was, if you like, the backdrop that behind the desire to pray, but obviously it was ultimately a gift of grace that made me want to take that plunge into prayer.
Yeah, when did you make a Mass? Because I imagine you never been to Mass before.
No, I hadn't, and it just blew me away. It was a whole transcendental experience where I had enough of understanding of the Catholic faith from my reading of Chesterton that I understood about the doctrine of the real presence and transubstantiation, and the very fact that at the words of consecration this great miracle was taking place was something which I was aware of. And of course, once you know that, then the Mass should be nothing but astonishing every time we go to it. If it isn't, it's because we're not opening our heart and mind as we should.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So it's, when you were in prison, were you able to access books? Were you able to continue to read Chesterton and other works?
Yeah, one of the great blessings of the prison sentence was access to the prison library, and of course plenty of time to read. I mean, lots of time on my hands. So, you know, I read, for instance, a book by the Jesuit philosopher F.C. Coppelston on the ideas of Aquinas. I also read, so that was my introduction to the philosophy and theology of Thomas Aquinas, which obviously is crucial. And I also read a book called Apologetics and Catholic Doctrine by Archbishop Sheehan, I think an Australian. This was a textbook used in Catholic high schools, I think, in the 1950s, but I came across it in the library. And again, very Thomistic, you know, the apologetic side of it, the first part of the book, you know, starts with the proofs for the existence of God, philosophically speaking. And for me, it was very important to understand that the unity, the marriage between fides et ratio, between faith and reason. I sort of got this from Chesterton, and of course it was reinforced greatly once I came across the ideas of St. Thomas Aquinas.
Yeah. So, you know, people say that prison changes a man. It certainly is true in your life.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it can work in both directions. I mean, you can go to prison and find yourself in bad company and come out worse than you were when you went in. But in my case, by the grace of God, and by, say, the foundations being laid by these great Christian writers, you know, it was the second prison sentence was a metamorphosis. It transformative, and I came out. I won't say that I came out as a much better person. I was still on the journey, but I was certainly moving now in the right direction and desiring the right things and not the wrong things. And that's obviously crucial because it allows you to orientate yourself and to move in the right direction.
Yeah. So I imagine that your friends who saw you go in when you came out, I bet they noticed a change in you.
Yeah, they noticed a major change, and for most of my comrades, of course, it was not a good change. In the end, I had to leave London. I had to literally move out to the countryside and start a new life for myself. Really, you know, shaking the dust from my sandals and breaking the connections with all but a small handful of friends, because I virtually everybody I knew was involved in the political movement. So I knew virtually nobody outside of it. So it was literally like starting completely anew with breaking all connections and just having to start a new life.
Yeah, was the action, reaction, was it anger that they were angry with you, or was it disbelief, or that maybe you're just confused?
All of the above, basically. Yeah. In some cases, there was certainly anger. In others, there was confusion on their part as to the confusion they saw in me and why this change. There were relatively few people sympathetic, of course, to Christianity in the movement, so I wasn't going to get much sympathy. And I realized that, you know, I needed to start a new life. I needed to actually get out of the world in which I had been living for the last 11 years and begin life afresh, and that meant geographically relocating as well as, if you like, psychologically and spiritually relocating.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, you know, it reminds me of Saul of Tarsus after his conversion. You know, he goes off into Arabia and hides there essentially for a little while, just to, I guess, get your bearings and.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose, you know, we were in similar situations. He was, you know, with a radical Jewish group that were very hostile to Christianity. So, of course, once he joins the other side, all of his friends will become his enemies. So,
yeah,
you know,
right.
He's, you know, sort of the same sort of situation I found myself in, really, is that you have no choice but to, you know, shake the dust physically and psychologically from your sandals and move on.
Yeah, very good. Okay, well, we're talking with Joseph Pierce about his journey into the Catholic faith and his book, Race with the Devil. We're going to continue after the break. You listen to Hands on Apologetics with Gary Matuta. Stay tuned, everybody.
This is Terry Barber inviting you, all the men, to a men's conference June 15th at the Sacred Heart Chapel. This is going to be a day where we're going to talk about true masculinity. You know, there's a problem in the Catholic Church today. We have very few men who love the Catholic faith. And I know a lot of the wives that I'm listening to right now are saying, I want my husband to be on fire for the faith. Send him to the men's conference. Your son, send him to the men's conference by going to virginmostpowerfulradio.org or call 877-526-2151. That's June 15th. When your husband comes back from this conference or your son, they're going to have a different view about their Catholic faith because they're going to meet three men who love Jesus and his bride, the church, and are going to instill in them a love for Christ and his church, the Eucharist, Our Lady. Bring them to virginmostpowerfulradio.org. Sign up there or call 877-526-2151. Full sheen ahead.
It is only because of your continued prayers and generous donations that Virgin Most Powerful Radio can broadcast live each weekday. We count on your spiritual and financial support because you understand the urgent need for Catholic programming that shares the gospel with clarity and charity but without compromise. Please prayerfully consider becoming a monthly donor. You can set it up with the touch of a button on our website, CatholicRC.org.
Buying or selling your home or your business property? This is Terry Barber. Real Estate for Life underwrites the Terry and Jesse Show, and they can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. And when they receive their referral fee, they will give 80% of it to a pro-life organization. Wow! That's 80%! RealEstateForLife.org, 877-LIFE-US1.
Now, back to Hands-On Apologetics with Gary Matsuda. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 888-526-2151. Here's Gary.
And welcome back, everybody. We're talking with Joseph Pierce about his journey into the Catholic faith from virulent anti-Catholic racist groups to becoming one of the best authors out there in Catholic literature. Joseph, you know, you were a source of grace to your father's conversion. During the break on our live streams, one of the people asked, do you know if any of your former compatriots also moving towards Catholicism?
Yes, indeed. One of my comrades has also now converted. I also receive one of my friends that is close friends, but I've also received emails from former white supremacists around the world. I actually received one this week from someone in Croatia. So people hear about my story and find out where I am and write to me. And there's an awful lot of people out there that have made the journey to Rome from white supremacism. So now that's obviously a cause for great joy.
Yeah, thanks be to God. You left prison. Now, when did you in seclusion? Was this when you decided to formally enter the church, or did you already do that?
Well, basically, when I left London when I got out of prison in summer of '86, I had a sort of messy year or so trying to extricate myself from politics. In 1988, I moved to the countryside, as I said, and I was received into the church in 1989, on St. Joseph's Day 1989. So actually, last week, just over a week ago, I celebrated my 30th anniversary as a member of Holy Mother Church. So
beautiful.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So now, welcome over home. Half my life, in fact, I've been in the church.
Welcome home. Yeah, that's great. So when did you come out of seclusion and how did you take up the task of highlighting these great literary writers, Catholic writers?
Well, as I said, under grace, Chesterton was the biggest single influence on my conversion. And so I'd read sort of just about everything by Chesterton and everything about Chesterton that I could get my hands on. So
wow, that's
a lot about him. And I didn't feel that any of the biographies of Chesterton had really captured the fullness of the man and his beliefs. And so I thought, well, rather than complaining about that, I should actually get my hands dirty, so to speak, and start writing a biography of my own. So my first book as a Catholic was my biography of G.K. Chesterton. And thanks be to God, that was published by a major secular publisher in the U.K., and so with the advance for that, I made the decision to become a full-time writer. And that meant, of course, I had to write more books before the money ran out, which was great incentive. Yeah. So I had wrote several books in the space of a few years while I was living in England. So for 5 years, the Chesterton book was published in 1996. And then for 5 years in England, I was a full-time writer. And then I moved to the States in 2001.
Wow. And were they all secular publishers, or were they also Catholic publishers?
The books published in England were all by either HarperCollins or Hodder and Stoughton, so two major secular publishers. But the Ignatius Press were publishing the U.S. editions of those books, so I was already getting a reputation over here amongst Catholics. So that allowed me, in fact, the job offer I received over here, which was from Ave Maria University, to join its literature faculty, that was a direct consequence of the fact that several members of the faculty and administration at Ave Maria had read some of my books already. So that enabled me, if you like, to make the transition from being a full-time writer in the secular world in England to becoming, I suppose, a full-time evangelist for the Catholic Church over here in the United States.
Yeah, that's beautiful. You know, if you don't mind me asking, what was it about Chesterton that you felt other biographies lacked?
Well, I think that basically my book was called Wisdom and Innocence, A Life of Chesterton, and I think it was that paradoxical connection and combination of the wisdom that comes from reason, but also the innocence that comes from a childlike heart. And this is this childlike innocence that Chesterton retained, even as he had a full-blown wisdom of the world and its evils. He still saw creation and humanity through the eyes of a child, but not with naivete. Innocence is not the same thing as naivete. Innocence is seeing with the purity of a child. In other words, to be able to see beyond the evil to the goodness that transcends that. And Chesterton had that great ability, and I think that informs just about everything he wrote and everything he did. And that was what I wanted to bring out in my biography, hence the title.
Yeah, beautiful. I'm kind of a bookworm, but it's all apologetics things. You said Chesterton was incredibly important, at least first for political views, and then he drew you in with the other, the other views he has. What other books influenced you to consider Catholicism?
Well, I mentioned my introduction to St. Thomas Aquinas. That was important to me, and to deepen my understanding of Catholic philosophy and theology. But the writings of C.S. Lewis, the writings of Hilaire Belloc were also very important. When I came to understand that the brilliance of J.R.R. Tolkien's Lord of the Rings was actually inspired by his deep and lifelong practicing faith, that also allowed me to delve deeper into the truths that emerge in literature. And I've always been a great lover of literature, so a large part of what I do is to show people how God, God shows us himself most emphatically and most effectively in the telling of stories. In other words, his own life story, his life, death, and resurrection, and the history of the church, which is itself, of course, history is his story. And of course, how does Christ teach us the most important lessons? He teaches us the most important lessons, apart from his own example through his own life story. He teaches us by telling us stories in the parables. So, the point is that story has great power to evangelize, and I've been trying to show that through showing how great literature has great power to evangelize. And that's really, if you like, what I call cultural apologetics, evangelizing through the power of beauty.
Yes, absolutely. Who would you say is most neglected, in the Catholic pantheon of literary greats?
Most neglected. Well, there are actually so many. The problem is, if I mention those that are neglected, probably very few of your listeners will have heard of them. But, there's a great friend of G.K. Chesterton and Hilaire Belloc, who's also a convert to the faith. His name is Maurice Baring. And between the two world wars, Maurice Baring, the way it's pronounced over here, but Maurice Baring wrote several best-selling novels that were hugely successful, even in the secular world. But he's a profoundly Catholic mind, very cultured, great novelist, very good poet, and a very cultured man. And he, for instance, is someone that I would like to see rediscovered by new generations of Catholics. But there are so many others. I wrote a play about the life and conversion of the war poet Siegfried Sassoon. There are so many great Catholic writers out there that many of us do not even know about. And it's a whole new cosmos to be discovered.
Yeah. How do you spell Baring, by the way?
B-A-R-I-N-G. R-O-M-A-N-I-N-G.
Okay. Yeah, yeah, well, I'm definitely going to look them up. Yeah, it's, you know, unfortunately, there's so many greats like, you know, Tolkien and Chesterton and so on. I imagine that there are some who are, you know, have just as great insights, but just didn't make the grade. You know, it hasn't become
Yeah, sometimes it's just an accident of history, you know, is that for some reason or other, some writers, they retain their presence and their readership, and others, you know, they're very popular for a time, and then they go out of fashion, and then it takes takes someone to rediscover them and then to try to spread the word about them, to actually, if you like, rekindle the flame that they sort of showed to the world, that sort of light of grace which they showed through their works. And that's what the part of what I try to do is to actually reintroduce some of these great writers to our 21st century culture so that they're not lost to history, which would be a tragedy.
Yeah, absolutely. And you've done outstanding work, too. And by the way, where can people get a hold of your work, what you're doing?
Well, I have my own personal website, jpierce.co, and they can certainly find my books on that website, jpierce.co. And if they go to faithandculture.com, they'll see what I'm doing with the Augustine Institute.
Very good. What are you working on right now?
Well, I've got a new book coming out actually in April, so just in a few weeks, April 15th, called Literature, What Every Catholic Should Know. And then the next book I'll be working on is Shakespeare, What Every Catholic Should Know.
Beautiful. Well, we'll have to have you back on the show to talk about them.
I would love that.
All right. Well, thank you so much for coming on the program.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me. God bless you.
God bless you, too. And that is Joseph Pierce, everyone. Beautiful writing and incredibly insightful. So if you haven't read anything by Joseph Pierce, you definitely want to pick it up, especially if you want to become familiar with G.K. Chesterton, Shakespeare, Tolkien. You know, he has some very good introductory stuff. I love his writing. It's just beautiful. So, so man, what a story. And by the way, I should mention that his autobiography is called Race with the Devil. It's also available on Amazon. Check it out, because what a powerful conversion story that is. All right, so it's hard to believe, but the show is almost over. Man, I tell you, it's such a gripping story. It just makes time fly. So I should mention tomorrow, we're going to have Father Patrick Collins come here, right here in the dojo, right next to me. You're going to see it on live feeds. He is also had incredible literary output. He's written over 20 books. He's from Ireland. He's an exorcist. He's written on spiritual warfare, last things, all sorts of good stuff. And what we're going to talk about is the intersection between spiritual combat and apologetics from perspective and exorcist. So I look forward to that conversation with Father Patrick tomorrow. And coming up next, you guessed it, it's the show that started it all. It's the Terry and Jesse Show with Terry Barber and Jesse Romero. Great high intensity talk Catholic radio coming at you. And well, what can I say? It's time for me to shut down the Midwest Command Center yet once again and turn off the dojo lights. And I hope you enjoyed the program. Thank you so much for listening. And again, please, if you can, please support Virgin Most Powerful Radio with prayers. Share us on social media. And if you can, we appreciate your generous donations. So, everyone, I wish you a blessed day. And the Terry and Jesse Show is coming up right next. God bless. Bye-bye.
In the 1990s, I lived and worked in Hollywood. But when my wife Betty's mom took ill, we relocated to Orange County. And it was during this time in our lives that I converted to Catholicism. Once my eyes were opened to the truth, I couldn't learn enough about the faith. But I had less free time than ever, especially with a long commute. That's when I discovered the real value of Catholic audio. listening to cassette tapes transformed my daily commute into a miniature retreat. And that's the beauty of Virgin Most Powerful Radio today. Since the podcasts are archived, you can listen anytime on our smartphone app. I know how listening to Catholic audio can bring you closer to Christ and His Church. So I encourage you to visit the App Store or go to vmpr.org and download the app today. It just might change your life. I'm Matthew Arnold for Virgin Most Powerful Radio.
Virgin Most Powerful Radio, sharing the gospel with clarity and charity.